I next met with Dr. Robert Orlowski to obtain an update on multiple myeloma, and to begin, he commented on the rapid evolution of data on the use of proteasome inhibition in this disease.
We, of course, have had the first proteasome inhibitor, bortezomib, for quite some time now. I recall it was approved initially in 2003 for relapsed and refractory multiple myeloma, but in part because of the great benefits that patients have had with that agent, there have been attempts on a number of fronts to try to improve upon bortezomib, or at least to provide other alternatives. And there's a couple of novel drugs coming through that look quite attractive. One is carfilzomib, and carfilzomib is a little bit different than bortezomib because while bortezomib will bind the proteasome and then let go, carfilzomib is irreversible, meaning that it binds and does not let the proteasome go. So the degree or the duration of proteasome inhibition is a little bit longer. You probably know that carfilzomib has completed phase 1 and now also phase 2 testing, and it does show activity in patients with myeloma that has relapsed and been refractory to the most recent therapy. And hopefully there are plans to soon file those data with the Food and Drug Administration to support a new drug approval for carfilzomib, which we all hope would be sometime in the coming year. And one of the nice parts about the drug is that it seems to have a very low risk of peripheral neuropathy compared to bortezomib, although, of course, so far no randomized head-to-head studies have been performed. The other benefit that people are looking for from proteasome inhibitors is that carfilzomib, like bortezomib, is an intravenously administered agent, although there are some studies now in the relapsed setting that suggest that bortezomib can be given subcutaneously. And there is a nice trial, it's worth mentioning, from the French that was presented and then more recently published, that was a randomized trial of intravenous bortezomib with or without dexamethasone compared to subcutaneous bortezomib with or without dexamethasone in the relapsed setting. And they were able to show that the response rate as well as the duration of response using measures like time to progression and progression-free survival were virtually identical, but the subcutaneous version had a lower rate of peripheral neuropathy, perhaps because the peak concentrations with the subcutaneous dosing were lower than they were with the intravenous dosing. So that's one development with bortezomib. But getting back to other directions that proteasome inhibitors are going, there are a number of oral agents that are proteasome inhibitors that are now entering the clinic. One of them, as you mentioned from a publication, this was actually led by Ken Anderson's group, which was with MLN 9708. And this is a boronic acid proteasome inhibitor. So from a chemical perspective, it's in the class of bortezomib, but unlike bortezomib, this can be given orally. And there is an ongoing study in the relapsed and or refractory setting that is showing that 9708, as we call it, has activity. And there also are now efforts to try to look at it in the upfront setting. For example, one trial is looking at it in combination with lenalidomide and dexamethasone. So basically a three-drug oral regimen for upfront myeloma. And we also are planning on a study in the post-transplant maintenance setting where we would combine lenalidomide with MLN 9708 to try to extend the benefits of lenalidomide maintenance therapy after transplant even further by addition of a proteasome inhibitor.
So I only thought of about 50 questions they ask you based on what you just said. Let's just go back through a few of these things. When you look, for example, at carfilzomib and bortezomib, What do you think the explanation is in terms of why you see responses, for example, to a patient who's maybe responded and then progressed or just progressed on bortezomib to carfilzomib?
Well, that's a good question. And this is still something that is the subject of research, both in the laboratory and especially in the clinic, because there is some cross-resistance between the two drugs. And what we would really optimally like to be able to develop is a way to predict which patient who has had bortezomib would best respond to carfilzomib, or in some cases, perhaps they would respond to retreatment with bortezomib. But one of the ways that one could perhaps decide that carfilzomib could work when bortezomib did not is, as I mentioned, because of the irreversible binding. Another one could be drug metabolism. The boronic acid on bortezomib is important for binding to the proteasome inhibitor. And if you were to have, for example, enhanced oxidative deboronation, that's the mechanism by which cells inactivate bortezomib. They chop off the boronic acid piece of the drug. If that mechanism were to be enhanced, then another drug like carfilzomib, which doesn't have a boronic acid, it has what's called an epoxy ketone, which is the chemical portion of it that binds to the proteasome. A different chemical would not be inactivated by this oxidative deboronation. And so basically it may work because you don't inactivate the drug.
Any research interest in looking at combined proteasome inhibition?
That's actually a great question because there are studies that have been done in the laboratory showing that, for example, there is another proteasome inhibitor that is in clinical trials right now. It's called merizumib. And there are studies that show that if you combine bortezomib and merizumib together, you can get enhanced activity, and the amount of each drug that you need to use is much, much lower than if you used only one or the other. Now, we don't have those kinds of clinical trials ongoing yet, but certainly if we could get equal efficacy with much lower doses of two separate agents, that would hopefully be much better tolerated.
What about moving these new agents up front? Maybe you want to talk a little bit on the data presented at ASH on CRD.
Yeah, very good point. And you're referring to the phase 1-2 study that was led by Andrzej Jakubowiak at University of Michigan, which was through the Multiple Myeloma Research Consortium. We know that bortezomib with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, as shown by Paul Richardson and his colleagues, is one of the best, if not the best, upfront therapies for newly diagnosed symptomatic myeloma patients. So what Andrzej and his colleagues did is that they took the lenalidomide and dexamethasone backbone, and instead of bortezomib, they added carfilzomib. And what they were able to show in a small study is that it was very well tolerated with less neuropathy. As I mentioned earlier, carfilzomib seems to have less neuropathy than bortezomib, and the response rates were excellent. The trouble is that from Paul Richardson's data, the VRD regimen has virtually a 100% response rate. So it's difficult to show something better than 100%. There was some suggestion from Andrzej's study that in addition to less neuropathy, the responses might have been seen earlier, meaning that it took fewer cycles of treatment to get to the same quality response. But ultimately, what we're going to have to do is a randomized trial comparing VRD to CRD. And actually, although this is not yet finalized, there has been a proposal to do that kind of study through the U.S. cooperative group mechanism, and that would be an intergroup study, which would involve the Southwest Oncology Group, the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group, and now the Cancer and Leukemia Group B, because they now have a myeloma committee as well.
So you also mentioned the other, you know, part of this intriguing new question, which is subcutaneous bortezomib, and just to sort of dissect that out in terms of practical issues right now, where are you in terms of actually utilizing that approach in your practice?
Well, we're just starting to implement that, in part because when you're at a big place like MD Anderson, it takes a little bit of time to change a standard of care. You have to generate new order sets, you have to train the nurses, you have to come up with new practice algorithms, and it takes a little bit longer. But we are starting to do that, and I think so far the information would suggest that there indeed is a lower rate of neuropathy. And it seems, I think, that patients have a tendency to be able to get in and out much more rapidly. There's less chair time, if you will, because they don't actually have to have an intravenous line put in to get the bortezomib. So I think clearly more studies will be needed, because so far we only have the one randomized trial, and that was in the relapsed setting. I don't see why it would be different somewhere else, for example, in the upfront setting, but until we see the data, I think we still have to be a little bit cautious. But many of the trials that are now being planned with bortezomib are switching at least to allow subcutaneous dosing, even if it's in the upfront setting, and some are actually mandating it. So I do think that it's an important new standard of care.
And, you know, another thing, and as you talk about trying to think about a study comparing a couple of different agents, is you would hope that, as you say, it looks like it's going to be less neurotoxic. Now you kind of wonder, okay, well, how neurotoxic is going to be compared to another new agent like carfilzomib? Obviously, it's going to be more convenient for patients, or it seems like it would be. But is there a possibility that by reducing the toxicity, somehow the efficacy will be increased? You'll be able to use it longer or more dose, you know, delivery? Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think that's certainly a very hopeful possibility because, as we'll get to in one of the cases that I suggested later, lenalidomide maintenance after transplant is one of the standards of care, but especially for high-risk multiple myeloma, it would be really nice to be able to incorporate two drugs that are active against high-risk disease. In this case, that would be bortezomib as well as lenalidomide. And hopefully, by being able to give subcutaneous dosing, you will not only have less toxicity, but as you're pointing out, perhaps patients will be able to continue on therapy for a longer period of time. And I think subcutaneous dosing with bortezomib is very attractive in a maintenance setting, and hopefully some of the oral proteasome inhibitors will come in that setting as well.
I know there's a lot of interest in the CyBorD regimen with cyclophosphamide. Another alkylating agent that seems to be used a lot in Europe is bendamustine. What do we know about bendamustine and myeloma?
Well, bendamustine is certainly a great drug in a number of diseases, and there are a couple of small trials that have been done with bendamustine and bortezomib that show what looks like attractive activity in the relapsed setting. And also there was a study done in Europe some years ago comparing bendamustine and prednisone with melphalan and prednisone in the upfront setting that seemed to show for transplant-ineligible patients that bendamustine and prednisone was superior. So I think, of course, we always have to throw in the disclaimer that bendamustine is not approved for myeloma in the U.S., but I think that if people are looking for other options than the ones we've discussed earlier, including either pomalidomide or carfilzomib or elotuzumab, bendamustine is certainly something that should be on the list. And in fact, the NCCN guidelines do mention bendamustine as one option for relapsed myeloma.
Interesting. A couple more things I wanted to just quickly get your take on before we get into your cases. First, update on one of the most common questions that oncologists have, which is, what's the role of autotransplant nowadays in the era of all these exciting data? You know, I've heard this expressed as, is it time to write the obituary for transplant? Where are we with respect to that from your point of view? And particularly, I was curious what you thought about the Italian study that was presented. I think maybe the first study I've seen kind of looking at novel agents with this transplant question.
Well, you're right that that is a hot topic, if you will. And I think that one of the best ways that that is being looked into is an ongoing trial, which is being led by the IFM, which is the French Myeloma Group, as well as a consortium of centers here in America with Dana-Farber, and includes MD Anderson. And the question being asked there is, patients are receiving induction with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, and then there is a randomization to transplant either as part of the upfront therapy or to consider it as an option in first relapse. And I think that's an example of a great study which has a lot of wonderful correlative science, which hopefully will answer the question, is upfront transplant, at least, still part of the standard of care? But there are a number of studies that have been presented, including some retrospective analyses. There was, at the American Society of Hematology, data presented from the ECOG study, where they compared lenalidomide with low-dose dexamethasone versus lenalidomide with high-dose dexamethasone. And what they found is that still patients who got transplant as part of their initial therapy were doing better. So I think that this is an important question to try to answer, but people who are trying to write the obituary for stem cell transplant as part of therapy in myeloma, in my mind, are very premature, because we're not yet at the point where we can get 100% complete remissions with just chemotherapy alone, and also even the durability of those complete remissions with chemotherapy alone don't seem to be as good as is possible with incorporation of stem cell transplant. And I think the key in myeloma is to both achieve complete remission and to keep remission there.
So another great bone to throw out in the middle of a bunch of myeloma people who feel like chewing on it is post-transplant maintenance and the issue of secondary cancers with lenalidomide. What's new in that regard? Any new data on that? And what's your current thinking?
Well, it's a hot topic, as you're mentioning, because we do have now two randomized studies, one from the French and one from the CALGB intergroup effort, that show really very nicely a long progression-free survival benefit for lenalidomide maintenance after transplant on the order of about 18 months in both of the studies. And one of the randomized trials now shows an improvement in overall survival. But both of those studies, as well as the Italian-led study, which looked at transplant-ineligible patients who were randomized either to melphalan and prednisone, or MP plus lenalidomide, or MP plus lenalidomide followed by lenalidomide maintenance, all of those studies are showing a small increase in second primary malignancies for patients who received lenalidomide maintenance, and I think that has given people some pause. Hopefully, we'll have additional information available at the upcoming American Society of Hematology meeting to try to tease that out further. One of the things I thought was interesting in this area, though, there was a debate at the International Myeloma Workshop that looked at whether patients with high-risk asymptomatic myeloma should just receive a watch-and-wait approach, or whether they should receive lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And this was based on data from the Spanish study, where they've done a small randomized trial like that, which so far is showing that, as you would expect, people who get watch and wait unfortunately progress, whereas people on lenalidomide and dexamethasone are not progressing at the same rate. And interestingly, they found two second primary cancers in the group that got lenalidomide and dexamethasone. But because they had very carefully cataloged baseline information on all the patients, they were able to go back and do, if you will, medical archaeology. One of the second cancers turned out to be a case of prostate cancer, and that patient, in retrospect, at the time that the study was started, had an elevated PSA. And so presumably one could expect that maybe he had, unfortunately, a small focus of cancer already. The other case of second primary malignancy was a JAK2 positive myeloproliferative disorder. And again, because they had the baseline bone marrow, they were able to go back and look and found that indeed, before this patient ever got a dose of lenalidomide, he had a JAK2 mutation. And I think that shows that it's important to be very careful in jumping to conclusions too quickly. We do know that melphalan in the context of transplant by itself has a certain increased risk of second cancers. And unfortunately, patients with multiple myeloma, due in part to their age and possibly due to immune deficiencies caused either by the disease or by the treatment, also have an increased risk. So I think that there is reason to believe that the extent of the second primary cancer due to lenalidomide question is less than has been touted so far. And at least until more data are available, for right now, we have not been changing our recommendations in terms of lenalidomide. We certainly have discussions with patients about this issue because that's important so people are well informed, but we still have been recommending in favor of lenalidomide maintenance, and really the duration for right now continues to be treatment until the time of disease progression.
And what's your concept based on from what we've seen? And actually, the listeners to this series heard Dr. Mateos talk about those two patients, actually, and that whole thing, the issue that you were just getting into. For practical purposes, currently, how do you view the actual risk? If a patient were to say, well, what's the magnitude of risk? What kinds of cancers? What about solid tumors? How do you put it together right now?
Well, you're right that not only have there been some cases of myelodysplastic syndrome reported, as well as acute myeloid leukemia, but there have been some solid tumors mentioned as well in the group that has been receiving lenalidomide. So I think that one has to be vigilant for both. And the good news is that we really need to not just focus on the myeloma aspect of all of our patients, but continue to do all of the general medical surveillance applications that are important. So that's part of the good news. The other thing briefly to mention is that one of the concerns that has been raised about lenalidomide in these maintenance studies that could explain why there seems to be a more increased risk of second primaries among the lenalidomide group is what's called ascertainment bias, which is basically that patients who get placebo unfortunately progress more rapidly, and then they fall off of the trial, and the follow-up on those patients may not be as direct, as long, and as detailed. Whereas because lenalidomide patients are staying on study for a longer period of time and their follow-up is more detailed, it may be easier in those folks to detect a second cancer. But I think that it's still important to follow all of these groups very, very carefully and to be aware that not just hematologic but solid tumors are a possibility. And ultimately, what we're hoping is that additional maintenance studies that are currently being planned will help us to further ferret out the answer to the question whether there really is an increased risk of second primaries due to lenalidomide.
That's fascinating. With all the discussion about this, you're the first one I've heard the thing about ascertainment bias. That makes a lot of sense. So right now, though, if you kind of look at the numbers, and we've played with those, looking at like CALGB or, you know, whatever, either the trials, How does it come out in terms of, you know, number of progressions avoided versus second cancers versus, you know, sort of the risk-benefit profile of maintenance? Since you're doing it, I assume it's positive, but how positive?
Well, you're bringing up a good question. I think there is still a lot that needs to be answered. We need to get data about quality of life, for example, because although lenalidomide at usually 5 to 15 milligrams, as it was used on the CALGB trial, is certainly better tolerated than multi-agent induction therapy, it still has some toxicity, including fatigue and the potential for rash and decreased blood counts, and that has to be factored into the risk-reward ratio. And of course, although I'm not a pharmacoeconomic specialist, one has to consider the cost of lenalidomide maintenance. The flip side is that if you really are delaying progression by 18 months, let's say, and people are living longer, the question at the time of progression is, have we lost the ability to use lenalidomide in a quote-unquote salvage setting? And are we therefore limiting options at that point? And if the disease has become resistant to lenalidomide, might that resistance cross over to other drugs? And just briefly, I'll mention one other paper that was recently published. These were studies led by Keith Stewart, which we helped to some extent in, which looked at resistance mechanisms to lenalidomide as well as pomalidomide. And what was found in this study is that the product of a gene called cereblon appears to be important in the mechanism of action of lenalidomide and pomalidomide. In particular, it looked like both drugs actually bound to cereblon. And if you reduced the level of cereblon in myeloma cells, they became relatively resistant to the drug's action. The reason this is important is we actually developed some lenalidomide-resistant myeloma cells. This was all done in laboratory studies. So what we basically did is expose myeloma cells to increasing concentrations of lenalidomide over a long period of time. And one of these cell lines was actually found to have a deletion of the gene for cereblon. And because that gene product appears to be important for pomalidomide action, that raises the possibility that if this occurs in patients, which we still don't know yet, but it may be that if you develop resistance to lenalidomide, at least some portion of those people would not then have disease that responded to pomalidomide because the target of the drug would be deleted by the myeloma cells. So again, we still need clinical validation of this, but I think all of these are important factors that we need to ferret out because we certainly want patients to have longer progression-free survival and overall survival, but we also want to make sure that we don't close doors and remove options at the time of relapse by using maintenance therapy.
Let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 80-year-old patient.
Well, one of the areas that is still quite challenging in multiple myeloma is the care of older patients because they still present with the same kinds of medical complications that younger patients do, but their ability to tolerate therapy is not always as good. And so one has to individualize therapy much more so. This patient was an 80-year-old lady who again presented with difficulty with a pain in her back and in her ribs and was found to have multiple new rib fractures, had a relatively low M protein of 0.9 gram per deciliter, which was an IgA lambda, actually was not anemic, nor did she have renal failure or hypercalcemia, but had a pretty significant disease burden with 67% plasma cells, also had an 11-14 translocation by FISH, and I left off the write-up that she had a deletion of 13 by fish as well. So we'll get to high-risk myeloma in the next case, but because of the deletion 13 in this patient and the fact that bortezomib is a very good drug that seems to overcome the high-risk contribution of that abnormality, and the same is true to some extent for lenalidomide, we went ahead and did a combination of bortezomib with melphalan and prednisone. This was according to the results from the VISTA study. And interestingly, the patient had one dose of, actually, I would say probably day one of this regimen, meaning one dose of the intravenous bortezomib, one dose of melphalan, and one dose of prednisone, and unfortunately developed some significant fever as well as some mild hypotension and wound up being hospitalized because of complications. And this is not something that is unusual. We were able to evaluate her, and we actually found that her SPEP had completely disappeared with respect to any monoclonal protein with just day one of her therapy. And probably we surmised that this was perhaps an example of tumor lysis syndrome. Because of her tolerability, though, we had to then reduce the dosing of melphalan and prednisone down to lower levels and also reduce bortezomib from 1.3 milligrams per meter squared twice a week down to 1 milligram per meter squared once per week. And this in part is based on data from some Spanish studies where they have shown that both VMP as well as VTP, meaning bortezomib with thalidomide and prednisone, can be given to patients with bortezomib once weekly, and it still looks like a very active combination with a very high overall and complete response rate.
So let's close out with your 62-year-old man.
Yep. So we now know that high-risk myeloma is fortunately becoming a smaller and smaller group of patients. If we had this discussion probably 3 or 4 years ago, the definition would be much greater. We're actually part now of a high-risk myeloma working group, which is being organized by the National Cancer Institute, and we're looking to develop intergroup studies targeting just that patient population, which is roughly 15% of all newly diagnosed patients. And I can tell you that the four criteria that we have all agreed on as now defining high risk, number one, it's high risk based on the 70 gene signature developed at the University of Arkansas. And that test by gene expression profiling, by the way, is now commercially available. The second criteria is the presence of one of several abnormalities by FISH. One is 17P, the other is 1416, and the third is 1420. The third criterion is primary plasma cell leukemia, meaning patients who just present with PCL, as opposed to they've had myeloma before and been treated and develop a secondary PCL. And then the third group, or actually the fourth group, are patients who have a lactate dehydrogenase level that's at least 2 times the upper limit of institutional normal. What's off that group are patients with deletion 13 and also people with 414 translocations. So the high-risk definition is getting narrower and narrower, in part because of the ability of drugs like bortezomib and lenalidomide to overcome that risk. But this patient was a 62-year-old gentleman who presented with fatigue and dizziness and was found to have acute renal failure with a creatinine of 10.4, a calcium over 14, mild anemia, and of course a big protein albumin discordance. Myeloma studies showed a 3.5 gram IgA lambda monoclonal protein, lots of bone lesions, and 80% involvement with plasma cells in the bone marrow. And by the karyotype, as well as by the FISH, there was a deletion of 13 confirmed And also Fish was able to show a 17P deletion. So 17P has P53 on there. There are a number of other genes in that area. And we don't actually know for sure which of those genes, or maybe all of them, contribute. But certainly deletion of P53 in other settings is not a good finding in other malignancies. So this patient we treated initially with bortezomib, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone, in part because of the renal failure, although we talked earlier about dose-adjusting lenalidomide, and certainly one could have used bortezomib with dose-adjusted len and dex. This patient had a very nice response with a drop in the IgA paraprotein to about 0.7 grams with induction alone. We did move on to stem cell transplant with this patient. I should say that the use of transplant in high-risk patients is somewhat controversial because there are a number of studies that show that progression-free survival in patients who get stem cell transplant and have high-risk disease is on the order of 8 months, which is just about the time that they're starting to feel good from their transplant. But nonetheless, we did proceed with transplant in this case. That reduced the M-protein down further, although still not to a complete remission. And then because of the high-risk disease, we elected to start maintenance therapy on this gentleman with a combination of lenalidomide and bortezomib. This was in part due to data that had been presented by Peter Sonneveld from the Dutch and German groups. They actually had compared VAD with PAD, where PAD was PS341 or bortezomib, and that group got bortezomib maintenance. And there was a suggestion in their trial that patients with 17P abnormalities did well with that approach. But again, I think that we are working on an intragroup effort to try to target high-risk myeloma. And right now, the plans are for a randomized study which will compare what we think is our current best standard of care, which is bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone induction, followed by maintenance with the same three drugs. And then the experimental arm, if you will, is the addition of elotuzumab, both to induction as well as to maintenance therapy. And hopefully that will provide patients with a benefit. We're looking at a pretty aggressive hazard ratio of on the order of 2.5 or higher, hoping basically to hit a home run in high-risk disease. Because right now, standard-risk patients, who fortunately are 85% of the patient population, have a very good outcome with a median overall survival on the order of 7 to 8 years. We certainly would love to improve upon that further, and we're trying to do that. But the high-risk people have a median survival on the order of 2 years, and so that's a group who we really need to do better for.
So I got to say, really cool study. Did this patient, you said he had creatinine of 10.4 in presentation, did he require dialysis?
Fortunately, the response to the bortezomib and cyclophosphamide and dexamethasone was so rapid that just with some fluids and also with some correction of his calcium and initiation of chemotherapy, his creatinine came down to about 2 within 2 days.
Wow.
He did not have any volume overload or hyperkalemia at presentation, so we were able to hold off on immediate dialysis, and he wound up being able to avoid the need for dialysis altogether. And I think that speaks to the likelihood that he had a very rapid onset of acute renal failure, because if people come in with more chronic renal failure, although this approach is still very helpful and can often avert the need for dialysis, we sometimes don't see quite as rapid a turnaround.
The other thing, just to follow up on the renal failure, you mentioned the possibility of dose-reduced lenalidomide, but this patient got Cyborg-D, and I know from asking other people that that's what people use, or they just use the bortezomib dex. But in what situations would you be not comfortable enough even to use dose-reduced lenalidomide?
I actually think that dose-reduced lenalidomide is very active, and barring, for example, a history of somebody having a poor reaction to immunomodulatory drugs in the past, let's say, pick an extreme case, they had an anaphylactic reaction to thalidomide, where I would be concerned to give them lenalidomide because they are somewhat chemically similar. I don't really know of any case that I can think of where I would hesitate to give dose-adjusted lenalidomide. It's really a very good drug. Of course, one has to watch their renal function because as it improves, hopefully, you're going to need to further dose-adjust the lenalidomide. And it is not uncommon to see patients who present with acute renal failure who get len adjusted to then have an improvement in their creatinine back to normal. Although I think the other issue that sometimes comes up is when people present in acute renal failure, it's a lot easier to give the bortezomib because of the logistics of it. You don't have to have patients fill out the questionnaire and get approved, and then insurance often takes a couple of days to approve the lenalidomide. With bortezomib, it's usually much more rapid.